Hi, this is Romel from Auroville Radio, and I am going to introduce to you a very special human being, Jean-François Nouvel, or else known as JF. JF is from France, and he has been specially invited by primarily the Auroville Council to come to Auroville with an intention to brainstorm on ideas and ways to evolve the existing decision-making and organizing processes. We have had a delight listening to radical yet rational ideas from JF throughout the 6 weeks he spent in Auroville. He offered his services to more than 10 working groups and committees in reaching their ideal goals. To give you a brief introduction to JF, he was a co-founder to AOL France, had a successful career with money and fame, but this was 22 years ago. He doesn't much associate with it anymore. He then made a shift to his more spiritual side to enrich his life even more. He is a person in pursuit of becoming a more conscious being. And in this pursuit, he has imposed rather innovating self-disciplinary precepts, which directly affect the social code and brings a change to what he refers to as invisible architecture in our daily life. We met with JF to know more about his time in Auroville and even more about his personal side and point of view, which could enable us into realizing the evolutionary leap that JF is proposing we as humans are bound to make. His ideas about the six agreements as social code, or his lifestyle of complete gift economy, to his mantra of wanting to thrive in life and not just survive. To help you pick on his brain even more, let's meet Jean-François Nouvel, our very own JF. In one of your workshops, you also brought up the topic, and we are also, as a collective, exploring gift economy. And you have, as a personal experience also, you're living a life of gift economy. So, first, if you could also explain how gift economy is working in your personal domain. And do you see gift economy as a real solution for worldwide, or is it restricted on some levels?
So first, about the gift economy itself. On a practical level, for me, living in the gift economy means that whatever I can give, I give. I don't sell it, I don't bargain, I don't do anything like that. If I can give it, I give, if I have. So I can only, of course, give what I have, either time or things or money if I have sometimes, you know, things like that. And the material wealth that I receive comes out of gratitude, out of gifts, not because I've sold something, like selling a conference or selling, you know, consulting services or things like that. They come out of gratitude. When, for instance, I do lots of things with companies, companies who want to evolve, not just to do business with companies, but really to serve the persons inside those companies who want to evolve, and then to evolve their collective, just like what I do with Auroville, actually, you know. So I would offer my time. And then I tell them, I ask them that they perpetuate the chain of generosity. Because we have chains of generosity. You know, if someone helps you someday in your life, very likely you will want to give something to maybe someone else, maybe years later, out of gratitude, not out of a debt, but out of gratitude. And I invite people I work with to practice that, to practice this gratitude, and to take responsibility for the power they have to give out of generosity. Now, they can decide to give to me, if they want, out of gratitude, not out of debt, or to give to anyone else or anything else in the way, quality, and quantity they want. And again, not as adept. So it requires a little bit of coaching, of course, because, you know, the corporate world and the conventional world, and conventional society doesn't really know how to, I would say, the rationals for those things. As for the more global question about gift economy, you ask me about the world. I really don't know what the world needs, and I don't think my little mind can have, you know, any big idea. The one idea that will work for everyone and everything. So I don't come from this place. However, I did this choice of living in the gift economy not from a social activism perspective, which I don't have. I don't identify myself in any way as a social activist, but as a researcher and artist, I would say. And I did that because, from my point of view as a researcher, we observe that a gift economy as a social system works better than the market economy. Much, much better. And you can understand that very easily. In the market economy, I will give you something if you have something reciprocal, which we call the condition of reciprocity. Okay? If you don't have something reciprocal to give me, either in money or service or something, some object, then I won't give it to you. Or you won't give that thing to me if I don't have something reciprocal for you. So that puts quite a restriction in the flow of wealth. In the gift economy, you don't need that condition of reciprocity. You need something else that we call context. You know, context like a wedding, like a village life, like doing things with colleagues or friends, giving your blood to a hospital, you know, things like that. You have context that define the quality and quantity of what you give or what you can ask for as a gift. But you don't have the condition of reciprocity. And that opens the flow a lot. But as a system, this creates much more social complexity. And we could never, until a recent period, we could never scale it up. It always worked in micro communities because of the complexity of gift economy as a social system. We need to track a level of information in the gift economy much higher than the one in the market economy. And we do well in small communities because we know each other, we know everyone's needs. We have a kind of very elaborate information system in our brains. We don't need computers for that. The market economy allowed a simplification of the system, very simplified system. Then we could scale up. But with this hurdle of the condition of reciprocity. But now, thanks to the internet and what we call the technologies of social complexity, the technologies that can help and support social complexity to emerge, then we can do massive gift economies. To the scale, to a planetary scale, look at Wikipedia. I mean, we have a planetary amazing tool and more or couch surfing, where you can offer hospitality, not to pay, but to offer hospitality to travelers or benefit yourself from a host somewhere in the world. And more, we will see platforms, emerging platforms, based on gift economy, how you can share tools with your neighborhood, or knowledge, transportation, healing, education, and all these things. Look at the MOOCs, you know, massive online courses, how it works. So we see the rise of massive gift economies. Now, they kind of work in silos, you know, and you have education, you have transportation, you have medical care, you have whatever, you know. But sooner or later, this platform will need to work together, to operate together. And we will need to have standards and protocols so all this wealth can flow and without the need to go into the market economy. And that will happen very soon. And I know that because I work with many others on those solutions, on those technologies and protocols that will allow for that. So back to your question about Auroville. Auroville has all the potential today and the vision to become a gift economy. That will require some learning, that will require some unlearning, that will require a specialized language, which we have for market economy, which we don't have for gift economy. So it will require some steps to make, but nothing impossible. Not like, you know, going to Mars, because we don't know how to go to Mars. We have some idea, but we know how to get to go to gift economies today. We know the steps, not as a perfect rocket science, but we have a very good idea about how to get there. So Aurovillians could become that.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to note that having gift economy going parallel with the existing economy can be more rational than having just one, choosing one or the other. It will be more thriving then. And there is so much of capital that we can look into, as you were also suggesting the other, in your workshop. There's not just money as your resource. There are so many other kind of resources. Once you have that in your knowledge, then you will know on which level you can trade. But we would also like to know you more personally, because we have a lot of you on the radio with your workshop. But just out of curiosity, what point can you say what that tipping point for you, which inspired you to not just ponder on ideas, but to make it an entire life discipline like you're living right now?
I can't isolate just one. I have different thresholds. One of them happened in jail, for instance. I've spent some time in my life in jail. I had quite an adventurous life in the past, and met my own misery in jail. And I had quite a spiritual experience there. Two times, actually. I went two times there, and I did a kind of second time to really get into that same experience. And but then, from that second experience, integrate it and make the decision that I would become the most possible best human being I can become. And from that place, believe me, I had lots of work to do. I had to go through lots and lots of stuff to kind of, you know, clean my stuff, my inner stuff, go to psychotherapy, rebuild my social life, and so on, and then go into spiritual practice kind of in a very conscious way and reconnect with my inner self and all those things. So I had to go through a different threshold, but one of them, as an important point, happened in jail. Another one, like 7-8 years ago, I made a vow that really came that morning, called the vow of wealth. You see, many people do a vow of poverty, which leads to taking away everything and then see your true wealth and all these things. And I think it really helps for many, many years to go into the vow of poverty. I understand that. However, I think we can also claim the vow of wealth. That means take responsibility for all the beauty of wealth. If you dissociate wealth and money, wealth means integral wealth, means, you know, happiness. As a musician, if you play music, have the best instrument. Why would you have, you know, a bad instrument? As a living being, have maybe the best clothes, the quality clothes made by, you know, consciously designed by conscious designers, made with the best fabric that respects the environment and all these things. I call it wealth. It doesn't say anything about consumerism or luxury. So the vow of wealth speaks to that, to embrace basically what the true, the good, and the beautiful. The true embrace truth. The good embrace the relationship with others, the alter ego. And the beautiful means creativity, always going to your creative self. And that brings us closer to wealth. So that came as another threshold, important one. And I had a few of them like this, like shifting into the gift economy 5.5 years ago, an important step. And I had a few others, like becoming useless. I don't remember how many years ago, but deciding to become useless means to really deeply practice any kind of mental ideologies of proving your worthiness to yourself and to others, your right to exist, like by earning a living, you know, all these things that we have in a kind of commonly accepted in society. So just, you know, when you look at a cat or a dog, you know, just these happy beings, they don't really care about their usefulness or their worthiness. They just exist. And we kind of have some pleasure looking at them. You know, they're such, you know, free happiness. And I think as human beings, we can also go there. But you have to go into some, you know, cleansing. and yeah, becoming useless and practicing the uselessness and the art of laziness really, really helped me as one of those thresholds. And I could go on and on with some of them, but basically have some ideas here.
Talking to you is mind tickling.
Thank you.
So I would impose a question to you, which, as you said, you've asked so many of the people whom you work with. When you choose to work with someone, you first want to check their disposition about their outlook to their life. Mm. So, JF, what is it that makes you get up in the morning?
So what makes me get up in the morning comes from pure joy of existence. I don't think we have a reason, a kind of mental reason to live. We can tap into some interesting things we love doing, but basically happiness comes as an inner state of consciousness that we cultivate. And of course, I cannot say, I don't think many people can say it works completely independently on the external conditions. When we lose someone, we have to grieve and we have our emotions, but we don't become our emotions. So you can still, you know, grieve and suffer from aspects of your life or your health or some loss and all these things and experience pain and still have this equanimity inside. The witness contemplates all this and can keep to this level of rapture, ecstasy. And all these things. So I like to wake up and reconnect to this state kind of instantly. And it works even better because before I go to sleep, I also place intention, like to give in the hands of my deeper self, my own, where I don't have the mental, but where dreams and the deeper self can operate and do the alchemy for that evolution.
Yeah, I think what you speak about programming your night is something very few people understand or have started to understand, and such an integral part of our life. So Auroville is a magic place for a lot of people who live here. They come here because they feel a different kind of energy. And all these people are very much psychic driven, which they realize they had no Auroville in their entire plan of action, but they themselves find themselves in Auroville now. Mm-hmm. So I would really be interested to know, how did you come to know about Auroville, and what is your connection with Sri Aurobindo, if you have?
Mm-hmm. So the first time I came to Auroville happened 10 years ago in 2007, and I had heard about Auroville from many friends, and some of them Aurovillians today are very connected to Auroville. I had read a little bit from Aurobindo and the mother, not that much, but felt the immediate connection, and later, of course, the years later, I read more. It feels like reading my own experience when I read Aurobindo or the Mother. It feels like someone has put the very precise words in such an accurate way to every experience I've had so far. I couldn't say that I have read intensively everything, like some people have such a deep knowledge of savagery or all the work and the writings from both of them, huge amounts of writing. Each time I can open any of these books randomly, which I like to do, I like this way of reading more than linear reading, and each time it speaks to something that I have already experienced. So I don't know what to say about it. It may look very pretentious. Oh, you know, this guy knows it all already. He just has to confirm. But I share my truth here. It just, so far, it has happened this way. And maybe for some people, they discover a possible place where they can go, and it can activate an evolutionary process. I also feel quite connected to Aurobindo and the mother, and I don't need to come to Rome real for that. That connectedness, it feels like, you know, tuning in like a radio, you know. You can tune in into some frequencies and or some specific states. And I like also to go into other places in the world where I can tune in some other energies in some places. And I think we all have this possibility to do so, yes.
So having given Auroville 6 weeks and given so much of energy and so much of time working with everyone, so what is the action plan that we have now? Where are we? And what is going to happen? Mm. And when are we going to expect to come have you back with us?
So let me take a metaphor. If, let's say, you want to create a team that wants to play the world championship for football, so you have very, very high expectations. And first you want the team to, of course, understand the basic rules of football. Then you will have moments for this team to regroup and gather and work on processes. That means to identify, you know, okay, on the field when the other team does this or that, how do you regroup? How do you create a line of defense or attack? How do you look at each other? How do you pass the ball? You build processes based on identifying some patterns, okay? And then, so first thing, you build processes. Second thing, you train. Because knowing the processes, you know, on the board will not work. You need to train to integrate them, and so that it becomes so natural that you don't even need to think about them. And then you go play the competition, and you cycle that again and again. You play competition, you got to learn something, you got to learn new processes, then you need to train again, and so on. And then you build up your capacity. It works this way. If you want to go to Mars or to the moon, same thing. You will learn lots and lots of processes of things to do on board. And you know that conventional conversation between the astronauts will not work. They have to unlearn social codes to learn new ones that will work much better and more efficiently on board. Cocktail conversations will not serve them at all, okay? And they have to then repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat again before they go into the spaceship. Why don't Aurovillians do the same thing? They just, you know, go into those decision-making groups with no training, no processes, and they have to deliver a worldwide championship, like play the worldwide competition, like becoming the city of human unity. Tell me about a competition here, huh? Or an ambition. So what came obvious, the first thing we did with the council, as our first, you know, kind of pioneering group, we divided this time in three. Like Monday morning, we have a process-oriented meeting where we give priority to processes to improve. So what kind of situation do you have to deal with? What kind of topic? Do we deal with vision? Do we deal with a conflict? Do we deal with a follow-up project? Do we have guests in the room? Whatever. So what kind of architecture and processes will we design for that? So they build the consciousness of efficiency by identifying patterns and response to those patterns through processes. On the Wednesdays, we train. We just do training. We learn new things. We see how the body works, how the breathing works, how the mental works. We do integral training. On Fridays, we deliver. We play the game for real. So they make decisions. They sign documents, they send email, they arbitrate, they do all these things. And we try as much as we can to apply the processes. And I just stay in the background to support that. But we won't slow down for working on processes, because on the field you don't slow down for that. But then you may think, okay, next Monday now we want to improve this or that or that. Okay. So going into this cycle has changed also everything for the council. And that leads to a big question for Auroville about, do Aurovillians consciously decide that they will send directly to the battlefield people making decisions, whatever group they belong to, or do they need a long, intensive training to build capacity so that they learn how to operate from a broader consciousness and then, of course, deliver better and play the worldwide competition on you know, the city for human unity. I think we have a very important question for Auroville, regardless how they will do it, but at least the kind of support system decision-making groups will have in Auroville. So that said, I made a proposal to come back in a year and help Auroville build an empowerment team. A group of people, of persons, or Orovillians, completely committed to training and empowering decision-making teams. So they don't involve themselves in any way in the decision-making itself. They don't share their opinion. They don't participate to other groups as decision-makers. They don't even state their opinions publicly. They commit to that. So they can fully serve the process to make sure that teams can make decisions from the broadest possible space of consciousness and help them design the architectures. Not as, you know, experts jumping in and put the authority and saying, you know, you guys should do this and that, but as a real servant, as inspiring people of service. But before they can do that, they need an intensive training, which I propose to give next time I come, like for a full month. Take a minimum of 12 people. I won't do it if we don't have those 12 people from Auroville. And then I can train them intensively so they can really serve. And they would do it not only as coaches, but I would say evolutionary coaches, because we don't know how to design the right processes. We have some that we already know with efficiency, you know, like the six agreements that I shared a little bit about earlier. But we have so many architectures to invent and try out from an evolutionary perspective. So this facilitators, these pioneers, this support group, empowerment group, would not only learn existing techniques that we have, but they would also become designers, architects, social architects. And they would propose, not impose, but propose accordingly to the needs of the group, some specific practice, and then we would try out and see what works. And that could become a very, very powerful evolutionary group that could serve all Auroville. So I propose that, and we will see where it goes. If it wants to exist, because I don't want to impose, I don't want to come as, you know, the number X outsider having the solution for for Auroville. I don't have the solution, but just, you know, something to propose, to offer, and we'll see where it goes.
Well, there's one solution. You can come and become part of Auroville. Then you'll be a voice amongst Auroville. But to speak on what you just proposed, I think it's brilliant, because we already have a system where we need a judge to, at the end, resolve the conflict. Why not we resolve it when it's beginning? I think it can work. I hope it can work amazing as it looks, and it is something in the making for us to all see and experience. So on final notes, I just want you to suggest maybe, you know, three things that people all over the world start doing which can trigger that transformational change that we are all visioning.
Three things. What a powerful question. So the first one that really comes to my mind, one deep, long breath before speaking. Just build that as a practice, integrate that. It came as one of my important thresholds in my life, I think 10 years ago, when I decided to also do that as my practice. And that has probably made the most important transformation for my own life, and not just personally, but the way I engage with the world. And I would say most of the leadership that people offer me to, you know, speak and to listen to me and to go into so many places where doors and hearts become open, comes, I think, from this breathing, because I can only speak with permission. I can't push or pull. So breathing, I would state it as number one. The number two, reconnect with the body. I think the vast majority of people in the world, in today's world, don't have a conscious body. Because of lifestyle, and I see different forms of poverty there. You may have people who don't have no access to food or clean water or education, and yes, they have a poor body, but I see people having access to all possible wealth, and they have a terrible body as well. So something independent from the external condition seems to build, to perpetuate a high level of unawareness at the body level. And that can become such a beautiful journey to investigate how our body works, how our vital responses work. And once we understand them, rather than becoming, you know, the prisoners of those phenomena and flows, then we can play with them. If I know about how my vital body works and vital survival responses and all those things, well, then I can build on that. I can do lots of things. So, second thing. The third thing, I would say, investigate food. It may look trivial, and I will never come, you know, with the ultimate diet that works better than any others, because here again we have some mental kind of wars, you know, who has the right one and all those things. However, I observe something. Independently of cultures and even studies, that a spiritual journey goes with a change of food. And you have a chicken and egg kind of thing here, speaking of food, chicken and egg. So if you change your food, if you evolve your food, that will evolve your consciousness. And of course, you evolve your consciousness, you will want to evolve your food. Basically, it says, I see the steps, you know, like one of the first steps, stop killing. Stop killing animals. We don't need that. It does not make us healthier in our minds, in our bodies, in our soul, and with the environment to kill animals. We can have a perfect balance without killing animals, just from the rational point of view. But basically, more on the consciousness level, when I stopped killing animals for you know, my eating or contributing to killing animals, that made a huge shift for me, one of them. And then I stopped eating animal products and using animal products. And same thing, I could observe something like a relief, like, wow, I can have such a great life without enslaving or slaughtering animals. I don't need to eat eggs or to have a leather belt or shoes. I don't need all those things. And I can build a very different relationship with animals. And then, you know, the thick stuff from Earth, like bread and rice and all these things, I see either from my own steps or from people all over the world, at some point they'll say, I don't feel that much interested in those things. Not for ideology, but just because your body doesn't want them anymore. You don't feel attracted to those things anymore. You don't want thick bread in your stomach, or pasta, or, you know, those things, even rice at some point, or cereal, you don't feel so attracted to them. And then, you know, you may go to fruits and vegetables, just that, and then raw, and then move on to whatever degree you want to go. That progression, I see it independently of religion, independently of culture, independently of ideologies, diets, you know, and all these things. It just happens. And I see people having this line of development everywhere. And I would invite it as a third exploration, to explore food. I like what the vegans say when they say, you know, revolution begins on the plate. Maybe we should say evolution begins on the plate. So we don't need to do it from a social activist point of view.
So don't move on from the raw, move on to the raw. I think it's a very fresh perspective on everything that we've spoken about today. And I would want to thank you, JF, for spending this time with the radio and spending time in Oroville. And we will definitely see you next year. And my intention from this program was to get insights out of you, which I hope people will enjoy. Thank you for everything. Bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.